The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has held its annual Goalkeepers event in Manhattan, New York. The event, which had the Future of Progress at its theme, underscores the possibility of achieving the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. Our correspondent, Anne Oudo, who has been made a goalkeeper by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, was at the event in New York and now reports.
7 years ago, in this room, world leaders reached a decision. A global partnership that birthed the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. To track and accelerate the progress of these goals across the globe is the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation's annual Goalkeepers event, which kicks off in this room filled with leaders from around the world and individuals with a common interest in achieving the global goals.
From our previous contribution,
the Prime Minister of Barbados, Mia Mottley, opens up discussions on the importance of access to finance in vulnerable countries.
We are seeing and seeing now the combined impact of climate, of COVID, and regrettably now of the war in Ukraine. In order for us to get away from that, we need to secure long-term funding. If we're going to get the SDGs going, we need to be able to have funding that is 30-year funding. It's have been right.
The request for more funding seems to be a step in the right direction as the Prime Minister of Spain, Pedro Sanchez, announces his government's commitment to the global goals.
Today, many are worried about how to heat their homes and pay the bills at the end of the month. So governments need to act.
The Global Take, America's number one podcast, where we discuss global issues from the Black perspective. It's time for our voices to be at the forefront of foreign policy. This is Alexandra Haidara, your podcast host. Today we're going to meet with Mr. Enoch Chikaba from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. We will discuss the impact of climate change in African food production, inter-African trade, and COVID-19 vaccine production. We talk to Mr. Chikaba on the heels of the Bill and Melinda Gates Goalkeeper Summit that was held in New York City in September 2022. Mr. Chikaba leads the foundation's work to reduce poverty for millions of farming families in sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia by promoting inclusive agricultural innovations that drive productivity and income growth for smallholder farmers in a sustainable way. Let's listen to what Mr. Chikaba has to say about all of these issues, and I'm really excited to have him on the show today.
So I know Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, they're looking to kind of provide the same model as it relates to the agriculture sector, like transferring that technology so that seeds become more climate resistant. How do you feel, how can the Bill and Melinda Gates kind of overcome those challenges of like transferring technology, because most of the technology is in the West and it require like Western companies, European, American companies to be willing to transfer that technology to the continent.
Maybe let me start by setting the distinction between vaccines and agricultural innovation and technology. While vaccines are dealing with human beings who are the same, if you want, at the end of the day, in agriculture is very specific. Because you find that some of the crop varieties that do well in the US won't do that much when you take them into a different context from an agroecological point of view, with agronomy and so on. So rather than transferring technology, we need to develop technologies there. You need to develop technology with the people. You need to understand the targeted product profile. Let's say you're coming up with a new seed variety of maize or millet or yam. You have to understand what are those traits that are important for those farmers and those consumers. That's why we work with a global network of agricultural research, which we call the CGIAR, which is a global consortia of research organizations. And they have centers on the continent. You know, we have one called the International Institute of Agriculture and Tropical Agriculture, which is based in Nigeria. They work on 12 crops, which are not global commodities, you won't hear about them, but these are the food baskets in those places. Things like cassava, things like yam, things like millet, sorghum, cowpea, and sweet potato. And these are what people call food where they are. But we need to supercharge them with research and development and innovation. That's the uniqueness of the work that we do. And often private sector may not be interested in those crops because they are not yet global commodities. You know, they won't be able to sell as much. So we are focusing on those because that's where research has been lagging behind. And that's where we need to supercharge those with modern tools. So we may transfer tools, but the actual products and solutions should be solving those communities' issues. So that's something I'm very proud of. Again, having joined the Gates Foundation, coming from the private sector, I'm able to do things I couldn't do in the private sector.
Yeah,
that's the power of philanthropy, and you need partnership to achieve that.
Okay. Well, speaking of that, like at the goalkeeper, there was a discussion on agriculture and food production in Africa. What are you hoping that the summit you guys will be able to achieve with goalkeepers and award winners? What are some results you're hoping the foundation will be able to achieve in the world, if you will, after that inspirational conference?
Well, I mean, I came back extremely inspired by the passion and possibilities. Although we had 2 years of really progress not moving as fast as we would want it to be, although 2030 looks really less likely that we'll be able to end world hunger, I came back with a sense that these goals are still relevant. We are left with 8 years to get to 2030, and we are way behind. But I came back with a sense that there is a willingness by the global community to do much more. Some people think we need to do that 4 to 5 times more than what you originally planned to do in order for us to meet up those goals in 2030. So that's the sense I got. You know, there was consensus across the board that although we are living in perilous time, we also have great promise. And that's where innovation can really help us to leapfrog some of those challenges. You know, we now have the power of using predictive modeling that we can fathom what 2030 is going to be from an agronomic point of view. And then understand, you know, the soil type, you factor in the floods, the heat, and you can get into 2030 today through predictive modeling. Now you can say, oh, if this is going to be the weather conditions, what do we need to do today to develop the crops and livestock that will do well then? So that's the power. It is the first time it is happening. And then we have, you know, the power of using data, machine learning, satellite imagery. We can now deploy all those to come up with solutions for the future. So I'm super excited that we are living at a time of possibilities.
Okay. And then speaking of that, like, what do you feel are like the main roadblocks, if you will, that's keeping us as a global community from achieving these global goals? Is it like government? Is it the UN? Is it just the private sector? I mean, what needs to happen now for us to at least get to reach a portion of them at minimum?
I would say three things. The one we've already talked about, which is innovation. We can't achieve those goals without accelerating innovation. And I think that is happening we and others are getting involved. We know exactly what should happen there. We have some of the tools that are ready now. And again, as I said, using predictive modeling, we can come with a pipeline of what will be available. So that's number one. Innovation is critical. The second one is smart collaboration. There's not one organization that has all the answers. We need to collaborate genuinely and for mutual benefits. And I'm sure this is where, you know, when you talk about things like climate change, where Africa has contributed the least of the emissions that are actually causing challenges of climate change today, of, you know, increased heat and temperatures and pests and floods. All those emissions came from the global north. So in this collaboration, it has to be genuine. Like, as you know, 2015 in Paris, there were all these pledges of $100 billion to be helping the global south adapt to climate change. Those promises haven't been met. Last year in the COP26, again, a lot of pledges were made. We need to double the funding towards adaptation. You know, again, so I think we need to look at genuine collaboration and people meeting the commitments which they say they're going to do. That is going to be requiring a newer way of collaborating, but also knowing that what is absent in one organization is present in another organization. And what's needed, you know, for us to collectively bring our strengths together and make sure that, you know, we can focus on these tools that we know will work. The third area is going to be investment. We need money. It's exactly linked to that. The tools are there, they need to be scaled. Philanthropy only focuses on maybe buying down the risk, proving that innovations work and there will be impact. But the real transformation to get that adopted at scale, we need the governments to be committing their own budgets, what they borrow. We need the international community also to come in with more resources and so on to scale what we already know works. So I think those three things are important: innovation, collaboration, and investment. Very, very critical.
Oh. All right. Well, you've said a lot there. In terms of innovation and working with the government, like, how do you see Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation? What are they doing to, like, help African governments in the sense of policy or even development projects with help their food, with food security, and food security? And are they... does the organization, Bill and Melinda Gates, do they influence the United States or Western governments in terms of addressing the food shortage crisis, the continent?
Yeah, we work on what we call country-led inclusive agricultural transformation. And that's the vision that agriculture is a catalyst and engine for economic growth, wealth creation, and really leading to structural transformation eventually. Countries like Europe, you know, all the European countries and the US, they all started with agriculture, where most of the people lived in the rural areas. And then agriculture provided the platform for growth with raw materials. Okay. And then eventually today, if you compare Africa, Sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia and Europe and the US, it's no longer top of mind for people in Europe and the US to understand the importance of agriculture as a vehicle and platform to take people out of poverty at scale. And the numbers speak for themselves. In Sub-Saharan Africa, you got 50% of all your people are employed in agriculture. They earn a living using agriculture. 30% of the GDP, your national wealth, comes from agriculture. Just compare, you know, these two numbers. in Europe, only about 2% of the people are employed in agriculture, and less than 1% of their national wealth comes from agriculture. Not because agriculture is less important, but other sectors came out of agriculture. So that is the process which we want really, you know, to give a chance, you know, to Africa, and South Asia, so that agriculture can grow. You can't do that without raising productivity of the small scale farmers. You can't raise productivity without innovation. That's why I'm going back to the innovation. You can't do that if farmers are not producing more than what they eat so that they can sell into the market so that they can get the income. Because farming there is a job, like I said, 50%. It's not a hobby. You are doing it because that's the only job we have. And if you are not getting sufficient income out of what you do, it means you can't send your kids to school. You don't have health care. You are not eating nutritious diets, as you know. Right now, there are more than 3.1 billion people in the world who can't afford a nutritious diet. The majority of those people are in sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia. They are on the farm. They're not producing enough for them to eat. They are not generating enough income to feed their own families, to send their kids to school. So you find that it becomes so hard. That's why it's so fragile. If there is another externality or another headwind, like conflict, 6,000 miles away from where they are, it affects them because of the fragility of this food system. And we need to make sure that we focus on those things. And then women constitute, 60% of the people that work in the fields, but they don't have the agency, they don't have the control of what they do. They are not empowered. And that's why, again, Melinda was talking about, it's not enough just to empower them. They must have the power. So looking at all these tools that we ensure that, you know, can raise productivity of land and labor, we can raise their incomes, we can improve their nutritional status, and we can empower those people who are always working. And these are the women, girls, and youth. We have to be intentional. And then you can't do that without an enabling policy. So we work with several organizations. We have an organization called AGRA that is based in Nairobi, and whose job is to work with governments in order for government to use the evidence as they develop their own national policies. What will really change the country? If your country depends on agriculture for employment and an income, then we need to put much more effort in ag. Today, in sub-Saharan Africa, only about three countries have allocated about 10% of their national budget to support agriculture. And that's the minimum. All the countries that have done well, you must invest in agriculture at least 10% of your national budget. Only three countries. The rest I'm putting in 3%, 2%, and so on. So we need to really raise that awareness, because the World Bank, did some studies a few years ago and came up with the conclusion that investment in agriculture in sub-Saharan Africa is twice as effective at reducing hunger, poverty, and malnutrition than investment of the same amount in another sector. So it's so crucial, it's glaring, but the policies have to align with that vision.
You've said a lot there. Do you, based on your research and your experience, do you feel like African countries are kind of moving in that direction to dedicate more towards agriculture now that we have this information, or there's still some internal roadblocks, if you will, to get them on board?
They are starting to move in that direction, and that's why we need to work with partners on the continent to highlight those success stories. You know, we have Rwanda doing well, Ghana is showing signs of that, Morocco. So there are a few countries which you can use as exemplars in terms of what they are doing, which is actually changing, and so on. So yes, it's just slow. We think we can move faster. And at times the governments know what to do, but they just don't have sufficient resources. That's what we are talking about. We need more resources to flow so that countries can now begin to adopt the tools they know work. So there are several things which we are working with several other partners, including, again, as Bill was showing, you know, just educating the world in terms of how important innovation is, and talking about what would be that change if it is adopted at scale. I'm sure he highlighted about a few innovations in his essay, and even in the goalkeepers, talking about the drought tolerant maize in Kenya and a short duration rice in India. These are the tools which are available today, but they must be adopted at scale for us to begin to see the country moving forward.
Yeah, I mean, when we were at the summit, I remember my favorite part was watching Bill Gates massage the kale leaves for make the salad. And I've gotten a chance to taste those Ponyo chips. And I was thinking, like, wow, this, I like the bag. I like how it's marketed. And I was thinking, where could this be? Where could people find this in the U.S.? And I'm thinking maybe like a Whole Foods or Farmer's Market, I mean, or Trader Joe's, like more of the like fancier supermarket chains in the U.S. Are you seeing some trends where you see more African countries and not countries, but African businesses that use those like traditional foods that are very basic in their home country and kind of get more fancier for the Western taste? Are you seeing like how accessible are those companies able to move into U.S. markets or European markets with their foods?
That's a very, very important point. Again, as I said, from a research and development point of view, we are already supercharging the technologies in those foods, which are very local. Like I was talking to you about yam, about cassava, about millet, about cowpeas. These are what people call food where they are. But again, this is what I tell, because I can say this as an African. You see, there's this colonization in people's minds of saying good food is foreign. If I don't have bread made from wheat, I haven't had food. But I mean, when I was growing up, we used to buy bread only during Christmas. That's when we could afford. We couldn't buy bread every day, made of wheat. But what did we eat all along? We ate what we produced. We had sweet potato, we had porridge from millet. And it turns out these foods are even more nutritious than overprocessed food and so on and so on. But it is a mindset which can only be changed by the Africans themselves. That's why I was super excited to see that chef talking about, you know, Ponyo, which is a really locally grown, drought tolerant, and so on. We need to amplify those stories. And for people to be proud of what they have. Because right now, one of the challenges, Africa is notorious for eating what they don't produce. And produce what they don't eat. They're producing cocoa to make chocolate. But can you have chocolate for lunch and go to sleep? No. They're producing coffee for export. Can you have a cup of coffee and go to sleep when there's food crisis? No. So we need to really focus on people eating what they can produce there. And that takes a lot of mindset change. We need diversification of production, diversification of consumption and trend, so that we can really begin to talk about what is that trade within Africa. Again, I can show you another statistics which is shocking here. The intra-African trade between African countries is less than 15%.
Oh, okay. It was a little bit less than that before. Has it grown? Do you think that it's grown?
They don't trade with each other. They trade with others who are outside the continent. And that kind of trade is not balanced. If you end up not producing what you should be producing according to your own advantage. So it is really something that we need to work on. There's the Africa Union focusing on African free trade area, which is exactly meant to improve intra-regional trade. The second thing is about infrastructure. A lot of the African countries, 55 countries, they're disconnected from each other. You know, it would be cheaper to bring food from Brazil, you know, wow, through the sea than to protect it from one neighboring country to another. So there are a lot of barriers that must be removed, infrastructure, trade barriers, you know, in across the border, you know, the administration needed to just to move goods from one country to another. So there are a lot of those things which they are really focused on.
And that does it for us on Global Take, where we discuss global issues from the Black perspective. If you enjoyed this episode, please like us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or LinkedIn. You can find us at Black Professionals and International Affairs at www.iabpia.org. You can also find all podcasts on Spotify as well as Apple Podcasts. So please like and leave a comment. Thank you.